We have special royalty in the house. None other than Mr. Jack Blackwell and Mr. Bill Hansen. Welcome to the Roadhouse, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Jack Blackwell has quite a history here. After his father died at the age of 17, he joined his grandfather, Alec Boostrom, on his trap line here in northern Minnesota's canoe country and heard all the many stories about his grandfather's past. Now, Jack has taken those stories and written a new book called Boundary Waters Boy. It's published by Northern Wilds Media. Jack and Bill Hansen join us now in the studio. Welcome. Welcome, boys. So, Jack Blackwell, I got to say, Boundary Waters Boys, it's like the ultimate escape. It just takes you right back in time, doesn't it?
It sure does.
What inspired you to write this book, Jack?
I wanted my grandfather's stories to be recorded. And as I explain in the book, his old cabins are disappearing fast, and soon there'll be no trace of them. But I wanted the stories recorded so that in posterity, people can read about them and understand what it was like back in the Boundary Waters in the early days.
That's right. And you, bit of a disclaimer at the beginning where, you know, you say you've done your research and this all checks out, but it is historical fiction. And could you explain that concept or that genre?
Well, the stories were told by my grandfather, and I remember them, I think, pretty accurately. But have I got everything right? And I had to do an awful lot of research to get additional details. And at the end of the day, I don't want to swear that everything is 100% perfectly right, but it's very historical, and historical fiction is the category that fits for me.
Yeah, and great research and great local sources of information. Talk about some of the folks and the institutions that you relied on to back these stories up.
Well, there's a number of good books on the Gunflint Trail, Justine Kerfoot, Betty Skoog, some of those books. In addition, the old game warden journals and diaries are online at the Minnesota Conservation Volunteer. And you can find that stuff and get additional details about the good old days. A thing I'd like to talk about just for a second is the homesteading program. You know, people moved here in the early 1900s and thought they could homestead all over the public domain lands, and that turned out not to be the case. In 1909, the Superior National Forest was created, and prior by Theodore Roosevelt, the president. Prior to its creation, all the land was prohibited from homesteading, but the people didn't know it. The poor pioneers came here like Charlie Boostrom, Charlie and Petra, and went to Moon Lake and started building a homestead and a couple of cabins, and they find out that, hey, you're never going to get title to this land. It's been closed to homesteading. Well, how many people understand how that came to be and what they went through? And Charlie was my grandfather's brother, and how my grandfather got up here.
Well, and fortunate for those brothers, they had the advice of the local land surveyor. Was that Ed Mulligan that
Ed Mulligan
sort of steered them into the right direction for ownership?
Yes, he came by one winter and stopped a couple of times, and he was keeping track of these early settlers and homesteaders for the county, and he recorded their names and where they were living, and also explained to them very, very sadly that they probably would never get title to their land, and that was the first they learned of that. So Charlie and Petra Boostrom decided to abandon their homestead at Moon Lake and spend the summer exploring, and at the end of that exploration, they wound up at Clearwater Lake, where a man named Lloyd Simmons had 160 acres and sold it to them. And that became the origin of Clearwater Lodge and all the cabins around there.
Yeah, it seemed like Charlie was quite the builder, quite the cabin maker.
Well, there's stories, and again, I can't confirm this, but they claim that he built over 100 cabins in Cook County.
Isn't that something?
Oh, it's unbelievable.
And had 10 kids?
And had 10 kids and took care of the resort and built all the furniture, that beautiful diamond willow furniture.
Wow. That's what I am so impressed by, the perseverance and I think the what would be endurance of these early pioneers. I mean, it's hard nowadays to make it up here. How could it have been 100 some years ago?
Well, just think what it was like here. The Superior National Forest, as I said, was created in 1909, and it was 1.2 million acres, give or take. At the same time, the federal government only manages the land, and the state, we all know, manages the game and fish. So at the same time the forest was created, the Minnesota legislature decided it should all be a massive game refuge with protection for all the animals. Well, the poor people trying to make a living had to violate the law to survive.
Outlaw trappers, right? Outlaws.
Outlaw trappers.
Well, and that seemed to be a pretty integral part of this book, of course, of the chronicling of your great your grandfather and his brother, how they were in nature, they were doing what they had to do to get by, but technically breaking the law, right? The game wardens and the sort of the, I guess you call it bureaucratic, what did I write down? Conflict that was created on the land because of what, you know, turned out to be maybe not the most effective management strategy.
Oh, it wasn't at all, and it took until the 1950s for the state to explain that it had all been a tragic mistake. But up until then, there were some big law enforcement cases. These outlaw trappers would get caught, and they would demand a jury trial, and a jury of their peers would find them not guilty.
Dismissed. I thought that, who was it? There's so many great names in this book. Benny Ambrose, right?
Right.
He was the one that got lucky.
Benny was a classic case where he got caught with some beaver and demanded a jury trial, and the jurors all listened to him and found him not guilty.
The best part is it was, hey, wasn't me, couldn't have been me, no way, wasn't me. He gets off, he comes back next day, wants his backpack back. Right?
Right. I talk about a big case over in Virginia, Minnesota, where the guy, Dusty Rhodes, got caught with 300 beaver that he was a buyer and bought them illegally. And Dusty's deal was he told everybody he'd created a beaver farm, and he was raising these beaver. Well, that's impossible. And the state produced expert witnesses that said biologically it's impossible, and physically it's impossible. But Dusty had a big trial there in Virginia, Minnesota, and once again was found not guilty.
Dismissed. Case dismissed. Well, and Alex served as a game warden himself.
He did. And
and Charlie? Was that right? All these trappers, because they had the local knowledge. They knew.
Yep. Alec and Charlie were both trappers and game wardens, and they got fired from the game wardens. Probably the most embarrassing moment of his life. And he told me a number of times he wished he had that to do over again, but they were out at Little Saginaw Lake living in a game warden cabin and patrolling the area, and they were supposed to trap predators, the wolves and the lynx and the fox, and they did, but in addition, they trapped some beaver and doubled their salary. Mm-hmm. And their supervisor, the game warden, found out and called them in and questioned them, and they wouldn't lie, and so boy, he fired him on the spot. And Alec told me any number of times how embarrassed and ashamed he was about that event in his life, and he wished he had it to do over again.
Riding for the brand.
Yeah, I say that he accepted the state's money and violated their trust in him, and out west, that's called riding for the brand.
That's right, Jack. We're speaking with Jack Blackwell, author of a great new book entitled Boundary Waters Boy, Alec Boostrom's Pioneer Life in the Canoe Country. And it's really fascinating how you've written this in, you know, first person, in the words of Alec.
Right.
How did you manage that, Jack?
Well, he told me those stories, of course, in the first person, and it was easier for me to relate them in the first person. I've got one more quick story, if I could tell it, about the good old days.
You got to get the Bill story.
Well, this is going to be a segue for Bill to get in, because he knows these people. But during the Depression, there was one black family in all of Cook County, the Lights. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what old Mr. Light's real legal name was, but according to my grandfather, everybody called him Hosey Posey, probably a kind of derogatory term. And so that got shortened to HP. Well, HP came here in the 1920s and scraped to get by just like everybody else, and had a place up on the Caribou Trail north of Lutzen. One day, one of the game wardens came along and caught him having poached a deer. And I don't know if he arrested him or if HP just said, I'll plead guilty. So his time came in Grand Marais to appear before the local judge. And he did. He was sworn in, put under oath, and then questioned by the judge. And the judge said, HP, did you kill that deer? Yes, sir. Your Honor, sir, I did. Well, have you ever done it before? Yes, sir. Your Honor, sir, I have. Well, about how many times would you say you've done it before? And poor old HP had to think some about this. And finally he said, Your Honor, sir, it takes a deer a week to feed my family. And the judge slammed the gavel down and said, case dismissed.
Dismissed. The man cannot lie. And that was the reality back then. People had to do what they had to do.
That was.
And yeah. And the law, well, that's for the lawyers to decide.
Yeah, they had to feed their families. It was that simple.
And it wasn't easy. There's a lot of struggle in this book, of course, with the timing and the Great Depression and the, you know, just the, I think, the remoteness of the existence in the winters, and the food wasn't easy to
not
to
at
come
all.
By.
You not know, at
Alec
all.
Was out there to feed his family, wasn't he?
Yes.
You know, that's an interesting story because it's, as most of us know, HP's, I assume, son,
mm-hmm. right,
John Light, was sheriff in the county. So
many years, very well respected.
Yes, yes. So like, apparently the lesson learned stuck. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Well, Bill Hansen, you made this book as Billy.
Yeah, yeah, that's all the North Shore natives call me Billy.
And I'm no better. I'm Jackie.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a thing. That's a thing. Everybody used to do that. So,
did you?
Yeah.
You're too young to have met Alec, though.
No, I'm not. I did know Alec.
Sorry.
I think that's why I'm here. Okay. He trapped a lot out of and around the Sawbill area. And, of course, my mentors, when I came here in 1957 when I was 3 years old. Wow. And so my first memories were of Sawbill. Mm-hmm. And Gene and Dick Ryken, who ran Sawbill Lodge at that time, and Gene and Dick and Alec were friends, and Dick was a very similar character. He had grown up on the range and trapped and hunted and fished his whole life and had deep, deep knowledge of woodcraft and, you know, how to do things in the woods. And I remember he would talk about Alec to me. I was always pumping him for information, of course, and he would talk about Alec and talked about him with great respect. And the very first time I saw that I remember seeing Alec and Charlie both, actually, our family went on a canoe trip up the Gunflint Trail, and we drove across the old grade road. And at that time, what's now the grade road had not been improved. So it was literally a railroad grade that they had just pulled the tracks up. And we drove across, and it was so grown in that it scratched the sides of our car on both sides at the same time with the brush. And we made it. We got a railroad spike in our tire. I remember that, too. And it goes flat in a hurry when you get a railroad spike. We finally got over to the Gunflint, which was the good road. And we were driving up to, I think we put in at SAG. I don't remember where we put in. I was real young, you know, probably 5 or 6 years old. And the road at the Gunflint then was a very narrow road, the north Gunflint was really one lane, you know, you could squeeze by with two. Well, somebody had run their pickup into a wet ditch, and it was basically on its side, buried in a swampy ditch, you know, and we pulled up, and my dad rolled down the window and greeted these two guys were helping this person, whoever it was that had the pickup, and greeted them fondly and said, everything okay? And they said, yeah, and we went on our way. And my mom, I remember my mom said, shouldn't we have seen if we could help? And they actually stopped us because they had a winch going across the road, and they were pulling this thing out with hand winches. And my dad said, no, that's Alec and Charlie Boostrom. If you want something done, just get out of their way. I remember he's like, you couldn't find two better guys for a project like that. They'll have them out of there in no time. So, and so then I was, you know, I was a fan. And so whenever he would come by Sawbill and I would hear somebody say, Alec Boostrom's here, I would hot foot it out there as a little kid because I thought he was, you know, a legend. I mean, I just was in awe of everything he did. And so my favorite story about Alex is, and I'm not sure what year this was, but in the early 60s, we got a new kind of canoe, new kind of aluminum canoe. And he was in the spring coming off his trapping line. And he had a canoe that was bent in the front. It was a Grumman canoe, I think a 15-foot Grumman that was bent in the front from an accident.
Yeah. It was Charlie's, and he'd borrow it.
Yeah. I always thought it was Alec, it belonged to Alec, but I remember asking him, how can you paddle your canoe when it's bent in the front? And he's like, well, I just try to keep the front a little bit out of the water. And he paddled them all. But so anyway, he was there, and my dad was talking to him about stuff, and of course I was there eagerly listening, and my dad said, we have these new kind of canoes, Alec, and we really think they're good. You know, they're really good canoe. New company. It was a company called Aerocraft, long out of business. And he said to Alec, would you like to try one? You know, I'd be really interested in what you think. Well, it was an honest misunderstanding. My dad meant take it down to the lake and try it for 15 minutes. And, of course, with Alec, if you're trying a canoe, you try it for the season. So we helped him load it in the back of his pickup, and I remember at the time thinking, that's kind of odd he didn't just carry it down, because it was only a couple hundred yards. But my dad thought, oh, he's just driving it down to the lake, and we watched him drive down and turn and go down the Sawbill Trail. He didn't come back. And I remember I was like, Dad, where did he go with the canoe? And he's like, I think he misunderstood me. And I remember my mom was not happy. And throughout the year, my parents were struggling then. And she was like, you know, you got to get that canoe back. You can't let it go. But my dad kind of understood, I think, what the problem was. So sure enough, the next spring, Alec comes in off his trapping, and I hear somebody say, oh, Alec Boostrom's here. And I'm like, oh, boy, I got to, you know, I ran out there. And he and my dad stood out in the canoe yard, and they talked for quite a while about other stuff, you know, just kind of beating around the bush. And finally, my dad said, Alec, I was wondering about that canoe that I loaned to you last year. And I remember Alec very sort of abruptly said, I don't have it anymore. And I'm sorry about that. And he never explained why he didn't have it anymore. But he didn't have it. But he said, I feel bad about it. I've been thinking about it all year. And so I have some stuff for you that I think will more than make up the value of the canoe. And he went to his truck and came out, and he had three wolf hides, and that were just, I mean, they were raw, but wolf hides. And I remember the one of the feet was missing, and that's how the bounty got paid. These were legal wolf hides back in the bounty days. And then he had a handmade cedar paddle for each member of our family, right down to a little one for me. And so I knew I was young, because it's a real small paddle. We still have it. And beautiful, beautiful. And I remember him saying, I said, well, when did you make these? And he said, well, I made them when I was out trapping in the woods. Mm-hmm. And just made them with his knife. And we have three of them left. Two of them got away from us over the years, but they are beautiful artifacts. And when he left, I said to my dad, you know, will the wolf hides cover the cost of the canoe? And he's like, oh, they'll like double the cost of the canoe. Easy, easy. So he sold the wolf hides. We kept the paddles, and they're treasured artifacts now hanging on the wall at Sawbill. So that's my favorite Alec Boostrom story.
And a great photo of those paddles in the book.
Yeah, I was going to say,
nice. Yeah, one of them's broken. You can't tell that in the picture. Yeah. So we only have two intact ones, but the other one's all there but broken. So,
well, Jack, you got any insights of what happened to that canoe?
I'm not sure. I talk in the book about one canoe being stolen, but I thought that was a wooden canoe. So I have no no knowledge, Bill, of whatever became of that aluminum canoe.
Yeah, I got the distinct impression that he didn't want to. He didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Whatever happened, it wasn't something
he failed the field test.
Something he didn't want to discuss. No, he liked the canoe. I remember that. He said it was a good canoe.
Okay.
But he just said very sort of plainly, I don't have it anymore.
We're talking with Bill Hansen and Jack Blackwell. Jack's got a great new book out. Very local book. Boundary Waters Boy, Alec Boostrom's Pioneer Life in the Canoe Country. And takes us way back to when we had several names for canoe country. It was Superior Primitive Area, Superior Wilderness Area, Superior Roadless Area. Which one's your favorite, Jack?
Oh, probably Superior Primitive Area until it became the Boundary Waters Canoe Area.
Yeah.
And then it changed again, of course, to Canoe Area Wilderness.
That's right. That's right. You know, it's maybe that time of the interview we can, you know, throw out what's changed in the last 100 years. What do you think's changed the most up here? If Alex was here today, what would he think about this modern age?
Well, as I say at the end, I'm sure he'd be pleased that the forest fires are back again and the land is being renewed and the tremendous vegetation that's resulted from all the successful fire control is now disappearing in the country is coming back to probably the way it always was in a cycle of fires and burned and grew up and burned and grew up. And I think that's very good. The other fascinating thing for me is the Indians. And I have a chapter on the Indians, and I talk about the local Indians throughout the book. But Alec married an Indian woman. And half Indian woman, my grandmother, and her father was a white guy that had one leg, and her mother was a respected Indian woman who was a midwife and very strong on culture and very involved in the Indian community, and so. I talk about some of the Indian people, and in particular, a guy named Walter Caribou, who wound up at Grand Portage at the end. And Walter told the story, which I heard myself, about this Wendigo event on Basswood Lake. And I should back up and explain that in those days, Indian people all had to disperse for the winter, because if they remained in a village, they'd quickly use up all the game in an area, and there wasn't enough to feed the village. But if they would disperse in small family units, they had a better chance of surviving. And that's what was going on with Walter and some of the other Indian families around Basswood. Walter explains how his father and his uncle went out hunting one day and planned to stop in a bay 3 miles away and check on another family that was living there in a wigwam. And when they stuck their head inside the wigwam, let out a scream and hollered that they'd turned into Wendigos. And a Wendigo is, in Indian beliefs, is a person that has changed and acquired powers and becomes a human flesh eater. And these two Wendigos, the husband and wife, had eaten their children. And they'd also chewed their fingernails raw. And now they wanted Walter's father's children. They wanted Walter. And so Walter's dad raced back to their wigwam and got his gun, and these two Wendigos had followed him, and he shot and killed the man, and the woman got away and was never seen again. And they built a fire and burned the man's body, and Walter claims that today nothing will grow at that site. Well, It's a tragic and astounding story, but I think it explains well some of what was going on with the Indians then. And it was much worse for the poor Indian people in Canada than it was on the U.S. side. The Quetico Park is a wonderful, magnificent area, but the Indians were removed, some of them in the middle of the winter at gunpoint, to get all the people out of that park. And today, when you think about that, it's a massive change. And you got to give at least the Ontario provincial government credit, because they came out with a formal apology in the 1990s to the descendants of those Indian people that had happened to. And then along comes the border, and suddenly those Indian people along the border have to decide which country they're going to belong to. And you know, in the old days, they meandered around across the border all the time. And there's still a few families, like some of the Pauls on Sag, that have managed to keep a foot in both countries, but very difficult.
What's changed the least? What hasn't changed? You talk about the forest itself.
The wonder and the beauty and the majesty of the area, and the fact that the Boundary Waters has not been developed. It's been preserved and maintained, and it's something we should all be incredibly proud of and just enjoy all the time and think about all that's gone on.
We're talking with Jack Blackwell. New book is Boundary Waters Boy. It's Alec Boostrom's Pioneer Life in Canoe Country. And it has got quite the endorsement here at the beginning, Jack. You've got this acknowledgement from, I think, credible sources here. Stuart Ostoff. What does Stuart have to say about this book?
Well, Stuart publishes the Boundary Waters Journal, and he does that out of Ely, and he's got a big following, and he's been doing it for 28 years. And Stuart says that in a statement that I use in the introduction, that after reading nearly everything he could find on the Boundary Waters for 28 years, this Boundary Waters Boy book has got the best historical information. It tells the story the best. So I'm very, very proud of that endorsement.
Yeah, and it's the storytelling and just the imagery, like when you had just talked about the Wendigos, that piece moved me. That was quite a powerful story.
Yes.
And every story in here has that effect, because it's so clear that you put us right back in time with your stories, Jack, of your granddad, Alec. It's quite a tribute and quite a legacy.
Oh, yes.
Something to be very proud of.
Yep.
So you'll be tomorrow at the Lake Superior Trading Post.
I will.
Signing copies. I think about one is show, about 1 to 3, I think we saw that earlier. Yep.
Yes, that's what they told me.
Right in the middle of the art fair.
Oh. There'll be a lot of people, Jack.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Good luck with parking. Bill, what about you? You've been up here a while. You've seen the Boundary Waters for a while. What do you think's changed the most and changed the least?
Well, obviously, the legal status of the Boundary Waters, the imaginary line. I really love the Wilderness Act because, you know, there's no physical boundary to the Boundary Waters. Mm-hmm. It's just an agreed-upon fiction. We all just agree that this is a special place. I think that's really a wonderful concept if you think about it. And it works. It sticks. It's working. And I know my customers at Sawbill Outfitters, they don't take care of the Boundary Waters because they're afraid of getting a ticket. They take care of the Boundary Waters because they love it and they want it to stay the same. And I think that's a really beautiful thing, too. I'm very pleased that the Boundary Waters is still open for fishing and hunting and trapping. There are very few people that trap in the way that Alec did. There were a few. Bernie Shydock, who's no longer with us from Schroeder, used to trap in that way up until until probably in early 2000s, even maybe late 90s for sure. And I always had a lot of respect for that, that he did that, go out in the Boundary Waters with, you know, for weeks at a time by himself and trap. So I think that's really cool to keep that tradition and have that open to people if they want to do that. And certainly fishing and hunting, it's a huge impact on my life and sort of tangentially influenced by Alec for sure, because I idolized those guys that had that kind of woodcraft. I wish I had learned more. Now I kick myself that I didn't try to learn more from them, but but at least I had the sense at the time to look up to them and learn what I could.
Well, let me ask you one question, Jack, before we let you go. You're retired from the U.S. Forest Service.
Correct.
Did that influence you, the knowledge of your family and the history of your grandfather? That instill something in you to do to work that long?
Well, I think so. I'm probably like most kids around here. I grew up hunting and fishing and trapping in the Boundary Waters, and for me, it was career day at the local high school, and the Tofty District Ranger came in and gave a talk about coming to work for the Forest Service. And when he was done, I raised my hand and said, "How do I sign up?" And I got a summer job out of that, and went on to get a degree in forestry, and spent 40 years with the outfit.
Well, I think that's what makes your book special, because it's written by a man who knows firsthand what it is to be in that environment, and makes it easier, I imagine, to, you know, remember what the family has said and to get inside the head of these people.
Yeah, I think that really helped.
I would like to say one thing, because Jack will never say this, but I first met Jack when he was working those summer jobs. He'd come up, he helped, I think it was it Les Coyer in those days that you were working with? Anyway, taking care of the campgrounds, and they would stop and eat lunch with us at Sawbill, and that was kind of a tradition. So that's how I got to know Jack, as a very quiet, shy young man. But he did join the Forest Service, went to college, got a degree, and Jack retired as a deputy chief of the Forest Service. So it's just one step below being the chief. So he had not only had a 40-year career in the Forest Service, he had an extremely successful career in the Forest Service, and really is a, you know, we're all very proud of him for that.
Well, like you say, Jay, it was in the blood.
Yes, that's special. Thank you so much.
Well, Bob, thank you, guys.
Blood, yeah. Thank you, Jack Blackwell, Bill Hansen. Jack's going to be at the Superior Trading Post tomorrow afternoon, right? 1 to 3. Stop by, get a copy of his book signed by the author. Boundary Waters Boy, best of luck, Jack. Take care.